The Forest Unseen is a new book by David George Haskell, A Year's Watch in Nature, in which David, who's in Suwannee, Tennessee, University of the South down there, biologist and a poet. And it's quick because in the South, biologists are also poets, I've noticed. I'm not sure why that is. It's the poetry of biology, apparently. Spent a year watching a 1 square meter plot of dirt and wrote a book about it. I mean, that's the good thing is he got a book out of it. And we'll find out what he found there because it's very interesting. He is a biologist, after all. And David's online with us from Suwannee. And how are you, David?
I'm fabulous. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us here. Are you English?
I am originally from the UK. Yes, I'm a proud citizen of the United States now, but I still retain a lingering, you may be able to hear trace of an accent. Not quite Tennessee.
Well, it didn't sound like Suwannee.
Not just
yet. I love
maybe
you.
Another 20 years and more.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Because this sounds like the sort of thing that a biologist in England might do, though.
Well, a biologist transplanted did it.
Yeah. So, I mean, go out and look at a 1 square meter of someplace. And for a year, a solid year.
Right.
Is that something you did back in England before coming here?
No, this was an idea that came to me here in the U.S. I guess it's something in the water here in Tennessee that makes people slow down and pay attention.
Yeah, it's even something that Darwin probably did. Did he? Because he did snails and mollusks, didn't he?
He did. And for a while, he also traveled all the way around the world. But once he'd finished that, he stayed in his little patch of land pretty much for the rest of his life. Looking at orchids and earthworms. His last book, in fact, was on earthworms.
Earthworms. So you can relate to that.
I can absolutely relate to the fascination with earthworms.
Yeah. Where was your little 1 square meter of earth?
The 1 square meter was very close to where I live in a small patch of old-growth forest on the side of on the mountainside here. So it's a wooded slope, all covered in leaf litter, lots of jumbles of rocks. And I wandered across that mountain slope until I found a rock that looked like I could sit on it for a little while, and the area in front of that became that 1 square meter that I focused on. It was an area I had not seen before.
So the rock was...
I sat down and watched.
The rock was crucial.
The rock, for my posterior, the comfort of my posterior, the rock was pretty crucial, yeah.
But could not the rock affect the outcome?
The rock could affect the outcome. In fact, one of the exciting things that happened during the year was there was an earthquake, and so the rocks actually experienced a little tremor of excitement.
While you were on it?
Actually, I was away from the rock while it trembled, but...
just your luck.
Yeah.
And one might think, one of us who are not, you know, like poetic biologists, that this would be a kind of a boring thing to have to do every day, but you see the poetry in it, really.
Yeah, you know, and the thing that I found was when I started paying attention, the trouble was not boredom. The trouble was there was so much going on in this 1 square meter that I had a hard time just seeing it all, being aware of it all, and then writing this book, figuring out which stories of the thousands of stories that happened in the year in this just 1 square meter, which ones am I going to tell? Because, you know, I want to finish this book and not have a thousand different chapters.
Yeah.
So it was quite startling, in fact, how much activity there is in one tiny little patch of forest.
Yeah. Has that affected your life subsequently? I mean, are you now the victim of huge overload at everything surrounding you?
It has affected my life in that same sensibility.
Yeah.
The idea that you can be in a place and just by turning on your senses, dive into the wonder of that place is something that I have brought into the rest of my life. And the thing as a teacher that I really try and convey to my students, if just a few of them could get that, I feel like I've done most of my job.
Okay, now let's talk about some of these moments here. Where do you want to go? The chickadees, the shivering chickadees, or the...
We could go chickadees if you like. Yeah,
the katydids and the noise, or where should we start?
Well, let's start with the katydids, since it's now winter and they're all silent now. But the... In the late summer in the Tennessee forest, in the evenings, the sound is phenomenal. All these insects climbing up into the trees and shouting out their mating songs. So it's a sort of big entomological orgy, if you like, above your heads. And the noise level in there is actually higher than in town. I've taken my sound pressure meter and measured these things. And what is that sound? It's sunlight filtered through plants and then insects blasting out into the world. So for me, it was a real kind of amazing experience to sit there and just soak in this incredible chorus of life's energy.
And were you able to determine, was there any variance in the mating calls? Or they don't all do the same mating call because that wouldn't give them any advantage.
Yeah, well, the males are vying to see who can have the loudest call. Mm. So within
a it's volume. Volume is important.
Volume is very important, at least in insects. I don't, you know, in humans, you know, the loud ones aren't necessarily always the more popular ones. No. In my limited experience.
Just an aside there. Okay. All right. So that was then. That was one day. That was in summer, right?
That was, yeah, in the summertime.
Yeah, summertime. I had it down here. I marked it summer. Okay, that's okay. All right, so that was all in one day. Now, that probably continued for several days or weeks even, right?
Well, How long, in fact. Beginning at the start of summer, you have a few crickets and some cicadas,
yeah.
And then it really reaches a crescendo and is still continuing, in fact, a little teeny bit now. So we had a thaw just the other day, and there are a few crickets just hanging on. They're the last little ones. So even into December, there are a few that haven't quite been zapped by the frost yet.
Yeah, hoping against hope.
Exactly. Just keep on singing to the end. I mean, that's a pretty good life philosophy right there.
Yeah. Do we have any idea of success rate of katydids?
A success rate of mating?
Yeah, mating, yeah.
Yeah, well, for the males, it's a few of them usually get more of the... Few of the males mate with a number of females,
oh.
And then a number of males don't mate with anybody.
Yeah. It's just like here, basically.
Exactly. It's more or less like... yeah.
Like anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
from the katydids, where do we go next?
How about taking our clothes off?
You did that?
Yeah. So...
What was... You're on campus there, though, aren't you?
I am on campus. I do all my radio interviews in the nude, of course.
You're so English, it's unbelievable. Was that to feel the soil with your bum or something? Was that important for your measurements?
It was. I wanted to experience winter as the animals experience it without all the technological little things like clothing that we have. So I don't know if you wandered in the woods in Wisconsin in winter and just had this overwhelming sense of, you know what, I'd really like to get naked here and feel the scorch of cold on my skin.
No, deer hunters do it a lot. I know that.
Right. outside of the fishing hole cabin with the little wood stove in it.
So that
experiment lasted about 2 minutes before my body entered a state of shock.
And describe what you felt.
So what I felt was at first a very sort of pleasing release from all these stuffy little clothes. And then within about 5 seconds, my skin literally was feeling like someone was burning it as the heat rushed out.
Fire ants, maybe?
Fire ants, fire icicles was what it smelled like. And then within a couple of minutes, my muscles had slowed down so much that I could barely move my arms and fingers. So at that point, I decided it would be a good idea to reclothe.
Yeah, no, that's the point where the bottle drops out of your hand. I know that.
Exactly, and that's always the point at which it's a good time to put your clothes back
on
when the bottle has fallen.
Now, as a biologist or as a poet, what did we learn from that?
Okay, good question, and one I'll be pondering for much of the rest of my life, I think. The biological thing that I learned from that was, so I'm a big animal with a very vigorous physiology, and yet I can only live for 2 minutes in those woods without having to bundle back up in clothes. And yet these chickadees that weigh thousands of times less than I do can survive the whole winter with no clothing, no heating, no supermarkets. Mm-hmm. How do they do that?
How do
these little hot balls of energy that are little songbirds make it through the winter? And so that particular chapter, that essay, starts with my experience of the cold and then talks about how the animals make it through. And to me, I know all these ornithological facts about how their physiology and their vision help them find food in the winter forest, and yet it still staggers me that they can do that here in Tennessee and then further north in Wisconsin, then up into Canada and up into the Arctic. There are little birds that make it through those cold winters.
Yeah.
phenomenal.
And the chickadees do it by shivering, right? Isn't that the conclusion?
That's one of their lines of defense, is shivering.
It helps.
And in order for that to work, you need to have an adequate food supply. So a lot of the trick is having receptors in their eyes that are way, way better than ours. So where we see just a twig, they see all the details on the twig, all the little spider eggs and hidden cocoons of insects.
Oh, yeah, I wondered about that.
And so they can tease food out of the forest, where for us, there's nothing to eat there.
Yeah, I wondered about that, about birds in general, their eyesight. It's got to be good because they can fly through the air and land on someplace where they see something in a bark, you know, from hundreds of yards. Is that possible? They can spot, you know, a bug or whatever it is they're looking for.
Absolutely. I mean, they have got, it's like almost in digital cameras when you've got so many megapixels.
Yeah.
Their camera has got way more megapixels than ours have, so they have much higher acuity.
Yeah. And do we know what they see in terms of the picture that they get? Is it like our things with cones and rods, you know?
It is, except it's got an extra color thrown in. So they've got the three primary colors that we see, and then they see an extra one. It's a UV. So they have colors that we can't even imagine, and then color combinations. You know, what does UV and red look like combined?
Yeah.
We can't even imagine.
And where can I wear it is my
problem. Exactly.
So they're trichromate.
They are quadrochromate. We're the trichromates.
We're the trichromates.
Yeah, we have three. Unless we have colorblindness, we have three primary colors, three colors.
Yeah, so they have like psychedelic UV eyes or something.
Yep, so every time you see a chickadee, you just know it's tripping out there on extra colors that you will never access.
I'm so jealous. This brings a Bergman's rule. Comes to mind here under these circumstances, don't you think?
I think Bergman's rule was at the very top of my mind as I stood there freezing in the forest. Bergman's rule says that as you go further north, animals tend to get bigger.
Ah.
And that's because they have proportionally more heat-generating body than surface of which to lose all that heat. So if you look at raccoons or chickadees, any animal that keeps itself warm through the year, the further north you go, the bigger they get.
Yeah.
The raccoons in Florida are teeny weeny little things. The raccoons I'm sure you have in Wisconsin are massive, great big things.
Yeah, they are huge.
Yeah.
They're as big as teenagers. Okay. You're not the only man who's ever been totally fascinated by a snail or a slug, but you're one of the few. And the description is actually quite lovely of what you, because you have a lot of time to observe a snail or a slug.
Thank you. That's one of my life goals is to spread the gospel of getting down on the ground and looking snails in the eye.
Yeah.
To see what we can learn from them.
And when you do that, I mean, where do you look, first of all?
Yeah, well, that's a good question because their eyes are waving around on the ends of stalks, right? And so it's a little bit hard to maintain eye contact, but that's important for a good conversation.
I don't know if you would you want to read that? Do you have it? Where you can actually, it's rather interesting in terms of observation. I mean, and science is all observation, right? And as is poetry. Science and poetry.
Yep.
All observation.
Science and poetry are both about observation.
Yeah, about
and
truly
let
seeing.
Me pull up this page here.
You got it. Because this is the way he works. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, there are a number of different snails. One is about snails mating.
Let's not do that one. Let's not do that.
A little risque.
Public radio.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is from March 13th when the snails are just emerging from the early parts of spring. The mandala, which is what I call my one square meter, is a molluscan Serengeti. Herds of coiled grazers move across the open savanna of lichens and mosses. The largest snails travel alone, plying the crazy angled surfaces of the leaf litter, leaving the mossy hillsides for the nimble youngsters. I lie down on my belly and creep up on a large snail that sits at the edge of the mandala. I lift the hand lens to my eye and shuffle closer. Through the lens, the snail's head fills my field of vision, a magnificent sculpture of black glass. Patches of silver decorate the shining skin, and small grooves run across and down the animal's back. My movements cause mild alarm. The snail withdraws its tentacles and hunches back into the shell. I hold my breath, and the snail relaxes. Two small whiskers poke their way out of the chin, waving in the air before reaching down and touching the rock. These rubbery feelers move like fingers reading Braille, touching lightly, skimming meaning from the sandstone script. Several minutes later, a second pair of tentacles launches out of the crown of the snail's head. They reach upward, each with a milky eye at its tip, and wave at the tree canopy above. My own eye bulges at the snail through the lens, but this monstrous globe seems to be of little concern to the snail, which extends its eye stalks farther. These fleshy flagpoles now reach wider than the shell and swing wildly from side to side. So I continue the chapter, sort of watching the snail and watching how it moves across the landscape.
That was very poetic. I loved it.
Thank you.
I think a snail should be honored to be described by you.
I was honored to be in the presence of the snail. In fact, Southeast Tennessee is renowned for many things. It's whiskey, it's universities, it's wonderful culture. It should be renowned for snails, one of the world's richest places in snail diversity.
So, yeah. Does the European slug appear there as well?
The European slug is all over the cabbage in my garden, but fortunately has not appeared in the forest. There are some native slugs, but the European slug is not.
So a slug is a snail without a...
Is a snail without a shell.
Without a shell, yeah.
Usually it has a lot more slime. If you're going to go shellless, you better have some other defense. And so if you've picked up snails, slugs in your garden, you know they will slime up your hands pretty quickly.
Which ones do the French eat? The ones with the shells?
The French eat what they call the petit gris, which is the common garden snail in France. It's Helix aspersa. That is, in the U.S., there are a few places in the U.S. where it has invaded agricultural lands and is quite a pest, in fact. California is overrun with it. And so I look around and see all these little potential meals running around everywhere. I love watching snails, but I also like eating them.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
Garlic and butter, do it for
you. Garlic and butter and a little parsley is my favorite way.
Before we leave the mandala, is there a villain in the piece? Is there a predator that preying on our creatures in the 1 square meter?
I think one of the conclusions of the book is that the line between villainy and virtue doesn't exist out there in ecology. We're all preying on other creatures, and also we're all cooperating with other creatures. So that there's a tension continually between sort of beauty and the brokenness, the cooperation and conflict that runs throughout biology and is the foundation for our understanding of evolution and ecology.
Yeah.
So in some ways, all of the creatures are little villains and little heroes all combined into
one. Maybe just the guys who come looking for salamanders for fishing, right? Trampling.
There are some people who come through and will steal salamanders from the woods to hook onto their hooks for fishing bait. That's a practice that I don't understand and have a lot of comprehension of. I think the salamanders are best left in the woods.
Well, David, fascinating book. I loved it, The Forest Unseen. I recommend A Year's Watch in Nature. Thank you so much for spending time and tell us about it.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a delight.
The Forest Unseen, David George Haskell, University of the South in Suwannee, Tennessee. Okay, and it's on Viking.